Turn once again with me, if you will, to Luke chapter 6. We'll be looking at verses 27 and following this morning. On our recent trip to South Carolina, we flew from Mosinee to Chicago and then from Chicago down to Greenville. And I forget exactly where we were. We may have been in Mosinee or we may have been in Chicago. I think we were in Mosinee. I forget exactly where we were now. But anyway, as we're waiting, if you flown much at all, you know that sometimes you hurry to get on the aircraft, and then you sit there, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait. Oftentimes there are other passengers coming on, or I don't know what the reasons are for sitting there and waiting for so long. But we were waiting, and our seats were in the back of the plane. And I think they still had the door to the aircraft open. It was a very cold day, as you know, I guess it was Christmas Day. And so they had the heat on the aircraft. Well, we were way in the back of the aircraft, way by the engines in the back, and it was quite warm back there. In fact, most people, I think, back there were pretty uncomfortable with how hot it was. And we're sitting there waiting and waiting, and one of the passengers hit his little button and called for the flight attendant, and she came back, and the guy started complaining about how hot it was. He was uncomfortable. He was sweating. He said, you know, if we're just going to sit here, can I just get off the plane? If I get off, can I come back on? And the flight attendant tried to explain, you know, about the heat situation, and they'll soon be closing the door, and it'll even out, and it'll be fine. But I'll go, and I'll talk to the captain and see if he can do anything about it. So she went back, and apparently, I suppose, she talked to the captain. And a few minutes went by, and this guy, you know, rung his thing again, and here comes the flight attendant again. And he starts being kind of belligerent about it, kind of ugly, and he used some expletives that I won't repeat, and he was just really upset and really complained. And this flight attendant was just as polite and kind and nice as you could be. The woman, the flight attendant, was very polite and kind, but this guy was belligerent, he was ugly, he was using bad language, and this girl, probably 25, maybe 30 years old, was just very pleasant and kind and tried to explain herself. So I give a lot of credit to this young girl who really handled the difficult situation very well. I suppose, I've never been to flight attendant school. I don't know if any of you have. I suppose that they teach the flight attendants how to handle belligerent, hostile customers. I imagine from time to time you have people like that on the flight who are uncomfortable and they want to complain. All of us in the back of the plane were uncomfortable and hot and not feeling very well because of that. We were all kind of fed up for having to sit there for so long. But he was the only one who complained, at least out loud and in very unpleasant terms. And this flight attendant, like I said, handled herself very well. I think she deserves a lot of credit for how she handled that situation. I think one of the most difficult things in the Christian life is being kind to those who mistreat us. Like this flight attendant was to this belligerent passenger. She was kind. She was polite. She did not respond in kind to the way that he was. She responded with politeness and kindness. This principle is stated most clearly two times in our passage today, in verses 27 and in verse 35. Jesus says twice here, love your enemies. And so this is what Jesus is calling us to do, to be nice to those who are not nice to us, to respond with kindness when others mistreat us. Now I think, at least from my own perspective, that is really difficult. I don't know if it's difficult for you to respond pleasantly to other people when they mistreat you and are unkind and are grumpy. It is a difficult thing. In fact, I think it's our natural tendency to do just the opposite. That is, when people are unkind to us, we are unkind to them. When people mistreat us, we tend to mistreat them. When people use bad language with us, our tendency perhaps, or our temptation is to use bad language to them. If they do something bad to us, we want to do something bad to them. I think that's the natural tendency. But Jesus calls us to act against our natural sinful nature, to respond to hostility with kindness, to show love to the wicked, and to be merciful to the abuser. Notice verse 35 here. At the end of the verse 35, he says, "You shall be children of the highest, for he is kind to the unthankful and to the evil." He bases everything here on the character of God. We can be kind to the unthankful and the evil because God is merciful to those kinds of people as well. And so that's the expectation this morning. The reason that we treat others as we would want to be treated is because God is merciful and kind to us. Well, our passage, as we know, is part of the Sermon on the Mount, what Luke might call the Sermon on the Plain. He says that it happened on a level place. It probably happened on a plateau in the middle of the hills or the mountains there around Galilee. But he's describing here what he expects from those who claim to be followers of Christ. If you claim to be a Christian, these are the attitudes and the actions that should be true of us. Today we'll consider the practical ways that Jesus instructs us to love our enemies. Today we'll look at the rule. The rule is love your enemies. Next week, Lord willing, we'll talk about the rewards for those who do this and then the reasons for doing it. So let's look first of all then today at the rule. The rule, of course, stated twice, love your enemies. This you might think of as the heading or the main category. This is the main command, love your enemies. And then the rest of the passage goes on to describe how you can do that. What are some practical ways that Jesus commands that we are supposed to treat our enemies, to interact with those who hate us? In other words, followers of Christ refuse to treat others as enemies. Jesus' disciples love others in spite of their failures. Now remember, we need to have a good understanding of what the biblical concept of love is. Our society, our culture, talks about love in very romantic terms, usually in terms of feelings. I have a warm feeling. I have a warm fuzzy. I have a particular attraction to somebody. I have a feeling towards somebody, and they call that love. But in the Bible, this kind of love that Jesus is talking about here really has nothing to do with romantic attractions or warm, fuzzy feelings. Biblical love is really doing what is best for the other person from God's point of view. Love is not primarily a feeling of attraction. It's an exercise of the will. One of the commentators puts it this way. Jesus did not command his followers to feel a certain way, but to act in a certain way. Love for one's enemies is an action, not a feeling. Jesus didn't say, feel this way about your enemies. He said, act this way about your enemies. Throughout this passage, the word for love is the biblical word agape. And you may be familiar with that word. That's the word that Jesus uses when he says God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. So it's the agape kind of love. It's the kind of love that God has for us. Agape love is genuine concern for someone, irrespective of his or her attractiveness or of the likelihood of any kind of repayment. So it's really doing what is best. Biblical love, agape love, is doing what is best for the other person, no matter what, whether that person is attractive or unattractive, whether that person can repay at all, has nothing to do with it. That kind of love is not the tender, sentimental feelings of romance. Biblical love is a practical demonstration of concern for the well-being of another person, no matter how you might feel about him. So you can't command somebody to feel a romantic sense of love toward anybody, but you can certainly command somebody to do what is in the best interests of that other person. You can feel very hostile towards somebody, if you will. You can have that feeling in your heart and still do something good or do something that would be in their best interests. So this is what Jesus is calling us to do. Not feel romantically or otherwise attracted by somebody, but to do what is best for them. We can love those that we don't even really like. Love is an act of the will. It's not a feeling of the heart, at least in the sense that he's talking about it here. Somebody put it this way, the command to love one's enemies is not directed to how we are to feel, but how we are to act. Jesus' commands are addressed to the engine of the will and not the caboose of the feelings. I like that imagery. Love is the engine of the will. It's a decision that we make to act a certain way. It's not the caboose of the feelings. It's not the emotions so much. It's more the act of the will. Now the object of this love is your enemies. Jesus says, love your enemies. Jesus defines your enemies as those who hate you, them that curse you, them which despitefully use you. Enemies are those who slap you on the face and take away your possessions. They borrow and they do not repay. They are the unthankful and the evil. These are the hardest people on earth to treat with love. We have natural affection, I think, probably, usually, for friends and family, people who treat us well, people we like, people who understand us, people who are sympathetic and compassionate toward us. We have natural feelings of empathy and sympathy for them. But when people hate us, when people take our stuff, when people curse us, when people slap us on the face, well, we don't naturally have feelings of compassion and sympathy and attraction for them. They are our enemies. These are the ones that we'd rather treat as they treat us. We want to hate them. We want to curse them. We want to treat them badly. We want to slap them on the face. We want to take their stuff. We want to make them suffer because of what they have done to us. Instead of treating others as we have been treated, Jesus calls us to love our enemies. We respond in the exact opposite way that the world does. We respond to hatred with good deeds and good words and good prayers. Lenski puts it this way: love sees all the hatefulness and the wickedness of the enemy, feels his stabs and his blows, but desires to free his enemy from his hate, to rescue him from his sin, and to save his soul. Love sees what is wrong, works to remove what is wrong, and does good for the one in the wrong. Again, I think that's a really good way to describe what Jesus means here by to love your enemies. In this passage, then, Jesus gives us a whole list of things that we can do to show, to display, to demonstrate that we have love for our enemies. Now, before we look at this list, we should recognize that in each of these areas, there are potential exceptions that pertain and extremes to avoid. As you read through these statements, you could say, well, what about this? What about this situation? Do you mean that in every single case in the whole world, this is the way that we have to act? Like normal, these are wisdom sayings, and in wisdom sayings like this, like the Proverbs, there are usually some rare exceptions. These are not airtight categories necessarily. These are ideals. These are things that are basic general expectations. But we all recognize that there may be some cases in which we can't precisely do what Jesus is commanding here. For example, we can't necessarily in every case give money to everybody who asks for it. In some cases, we have to exercise judgment and we must condemn. In some cases, we must defend ourselves. So we recognize that there are certain rare exceptions to some of these rules that Jesus is giving us here. As I said, he's presenting ideals and general expectations, not airtight categories. If we try to implement every one of these things in a literal way, we may run into some trouble. But with that in mind, we still have to follow these guidelines to the best of our ability. These are the general rules to follow, even though there are some exceptions to the rules. These are the kinds of attitudes and actions that Jesus outlines for us. This is the way that we are supposed to live. So the general rule here is to love your enemies, and then the following statements, the following commands, tell us how we are supposed to do that. What does it mean to love our enemies? How do we put these commands into practice? Well, the rest of the passage here shows us how to do that. And so he starts in verse 27 by saying, "But I say unto you which hear." So he's starting a new part of the Sermon on the Mount. He's given the Beatitudes, the blessed are those. And then he's given the set of woes, woe unto you who do or have this or that. And now he's starting a new part of the Sermon on the Mount. And he's clearly talking to believers here. He says, those who hear, them which you who hear, you which hear. So he's talking to his disciples. Remember, his disciples are there along with a great multitude of other people who are not his disciples. But I think he's specifically talking to believers. And so he's giving commands to those who are already his disciples. These commands are not conditions to become a disciple, but attitudes and actions that should be true of Jesus' disciples. These actions and attitudes are the result of salvation and not the cause. So we don't look at the Sermon on the Mount and say, if I fulfill these conditions, I will be a child of God. No, we fulfill these conditions because we are the child or the children of God. It's the result. It's not a cause. So let's consider this morning several practical ways that Jesus instructs us to love our enemies. Now, my outline has categorized Jesus' commands a little bit differently than the order that they flow in the text. I've tried to put all the commands, first of all, together, everything that Jesus commands us to do from the passage. So we'll be skipping around a little bit here to put all the commands in order. So you might have to follow along as we go through. So, how do we love our enemies? Well, first of all, in verse 27, he says, do good to them which hate you. Jesus assumes that his followers will be hated. And we should assume that as well. Jesus said in Luke 21:17, you will be hated by all men for my name's sake. You will suffer hostility. You will suffer opposition if you are a follower of Christ. Now, more and more in our country, that is the case. Let's say you want to bake cakes for a living, but you don't want to bake cakes for certain people who are going to use those cakes in a ceremony that you deeply disagree with. Well, you might be fined $135,000 by the state if you disagree, if you refuse to bake a cake for, in this case, a homosexual wedding. If you say what you believe about certain things, you may be shut down. You may not be able to say what you believe without facing certain consequences. That's the way it is today in many parts of Europe. That's the way today it is in Canada. And that's the way it will be here in the United States. Eventually, they will try to shut Christians down for saying what they believe. And so we will be hated. We should not be surprised when we experience hatred and hostility for the name of Christ. So what are we supposed to do in that case? Jesus doesn't say just tolerate it. Just put up with it is not what he says. He says do good to those who hate you. So we don't just passively tolerate hatred. We are to be active in our response to it. And our response to hatred is to do good to those who hate us. Now, I don't know about you. If you've tried to do good to those who hate you or who are mean and nasty to you, but it is a difficult thing. I find it very difficult to be kind to those who hate me. Now, I don't know that there's a lot of people, I suppose, who hate me, but in my experience, there have been a few, and it's very difficult to respond properly, to respond nicely to those who are not nice. So how do we do good? What are the kinds of things that we can do to those who hate us, to those who are in opposition to us? Well, he goes on to say in verse 28, bless them that curse you. The word bless literally means to speak well of. When others speak evil of you, what you are supposed to do is to speak well of them. Say nice things about those who say evil things about you. Now again, what is our tendency? What is our propensity to do? When other people say nasty things about us, say nasty things about those who say nasty things about us. But that is obviously not what we're supposed to do. We are to say nice things, bless them, say good things about those who speak evil of us. James tells us that if we can control our tongue, it's a sign of Christian maturity. We have to sometimes bridle our tongue. Sometimes, as the old saying goes, I guess it's not biblical, but I think it's true, if you can't say something nice about somebody, just don't say anything at all. And sometimes that's what we have to do. We have to bite our tongue and not respond in kind. We may want to say something evil. If you're like me, something, a good response, a really harsh, a really caustic, a really sharp response comes to your mind. You know what you want to say. You're ready to say it. And then a little voice tells you, don't say that. You better not say that. Just bite your tongue. You're just going to get in more trouble if you say what you want to say. So sometimes you can just give them a look, you know, just use that look that you use. And you can kind of communicate the same thing. Well, no, you don't even want to do that. You want to respond positively. And that, to me, is a very difficult thing. And all these things, frankly, that Jesus commands are a very difficult thing to do. We cannot do them. They're impossible to do without the Spirit of God. And this is where we have to yield, and we'll talk about that. We have to submit ourselves to the Spirit of God so that we can respond in this way. So do good. He says, bless them that curse you. He goes on in verse 28, pray for those who despitefully use you. Now you might say, yeah, I'm going to pray down those imprecatory prayers. I'm going to pray down God's wrath, and I'm going to pray down fire and brimstone on that person. Well, no, I don't think that that's what he's talking about here. We should pray good things for those who despitefully use us. Primarily, I think we pray that God would change their hearts and not give them what their deeds deserve. If they're treating us badly, they may deserve God's wrath and condemnation, but we don't pray that that's what they would receive. In fact, it's just like Jesus when he hung on the cross, what was on his mind regarding those who put him there. He said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Jesus had great compassion, even for the people who put him on the cross. And so that's the kind of prayer that we ought to have for those who are hostile against us. We pray for them. Of course, the greatest thing that we could pray is that they would be saved, start living biblically, and stop abusing others. If they got saved, then they would not be the enemy. Then they would not be misusing and mistreating other people. So we pray that our enemies would be saved and sanctified, saved and starting to lead a godly Christian life. And then, of course, they'd no longer be our enemies. They'd be our friends. In verse 29, he goes on to tell us another way that we can love our enemies. Turn the other cheek to the one who slaps you. He says, and to him that smiteth thee. Of course, that's talking about a slap or even a punch. That smiteth thee on one cheek, offer also the other. A slap on the face in those days amounted to anything from a simple insult to an act of violence. The commentators are sort of divided as to what the slap on the face meant. Was it simply an insult, or was it an act of violence perhaps committed in a robbery? Well, those who hate us might insult us, or they might actually commit acts of violence against us. And so again, what is the most natural thing to do? If somebody hauls off and slaps you on the face, what is your natural inclination to do? Slap them back. Have you ever had two kids in the back of the car? They're sitting there. One goes, and the other goes, and pretty soon they're bang, bang. Mom, he hit me. Mom, she hit me. Exactly what is done to one is what the other does to the other. And so that does not stop somewhere in childhood. That goes often through the rest of our lives, that what somebody does to us, we feel like we have to do to the other person. Probably the least natural thing to do is to give the abuser another opportunity to hurt you. Now that might be verbal, it might be violence, it might be any number of things. When people hurt you, you usually try to protect yourself or run away or something, but you don't generally give the abuser another opportunity to do the very same thing. But when Jesus says here, present the other cheek, that's exactly what he's saying. Offer the other cheek also. So again, this goes directly against what we would want to do. When somebody, you know, hits you in the mouth, you just don't naturally turn the other cheek. It's something that is almost supernatural that it would lead us to do that kind of thing. You may remember that this was Jesus' attitude as he was arrested and tortured before his crucifixion. Jesus fulfilled this prophecy from Isaiah 50, verse 6. I gave my back to those who struck me, and my cheeks to those who plucked out the beard. I did not hide my face from shame and spitting. Jesus willingly offered himself to his torturers, and he did not withdraw. He didn't try to protect himself. He took it. So I think the basic principle here is to not seek revenge when others are mistreating us. That might mean that we tolerate a degree of abuse. We don't respond in kind. We respond to abuse with mercy, grace, and patience. As Romans 12 says, beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. Give place, tolerate the evil that is done to you, it says. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And so as others are hostile to us, as others are mistreating us, what we are supposed to do is, at least in most cases, in many cases, maybe there are exceptions again, but if we can tolerate it, if we can put up with it and be merciful and gracious and tolerate that kind of abuse, that's what God calls us to do. And then we are to give generously to those who ask from you. A primary characteristic of love is that it gives willingly and generously. What Jesus is advocating here is the kind of open-handed sharing of resources that would be true in a close-knit family. He's basically saying, treat your enemy as a close family member. We should deal with others as if they are friends and not as if they were enemies. We should share generously without concern for repayment. So if you have a friend, or especially a member of your family, who is in deep, let's say, financial need, you just give them the money if you can. You don't start talking about, well, here's the loan, here's the term, here's how long you have to pay it off, here's going to be the interest rate. You just say, you need a couple hundred dollars? Okay, here's a couple hundred dollars. You are a friend. You are a close family member. I'm not, frankly, all that worried about repayment or interest or anything like that. I have the money. You have the need. Here you go. You just don't worry about repayment. And so that's kind of the idea here. You just give generously without concern for repayment. So notice the language here in verses 29, the second part of it. Him that taketh away thy cloak, forbid not to take thy coat also. Now the cloak, I'm told, is the outer garment, the long robe. We would call it a coat probably today, the outside garment. And the coat was the inner garment or the tunic. The outer garment was the more valuable item. And so if somebody took that from you, he's saying, don't hesitate then to give your coat or your tunic, your inner garment as well. Now this sounds a little bit like a situation where somebody is being robbed or held up. So the question then becomes, are we not supposed to resist the thief? Are we not supposed to recover stolen goods? Well, of course, normally we would resist the thief, and normally we would try to get back our stolen items. But there are times when it's appropriate to forego our rights instead of demanding our rights. The Bible gives us some examples when we stand up for our rights, where we resist evil. But then there are other examples where we forego our rights and we don't resist evil. So we have to use wisdom to decide what is the appropriate response. There may be times when it's in the best interest of the other person simply to allow yourself to be mistreated. You're concerned about that other person's soul. You want to see him or her be saved. There may be any number of reasons that you would allow yourself to be mistreated, allow yourself your things to be taken, and not to pursue a repayment or to get your stolen items back. So the default attitude is that we are willing to give up our things for the benefit of people. What really is more important, things or people? What's more important, money or souls? So we have to see the value of the individual, and if it's for the benefit of the individual to let ourselves be robbed, as it were, to let ourselves suffer loss, if that other person, if some way that might lead to a gospel presentation or their salvation, or for whatever reason it might be in their best interest, we should be willing to do that. Jesus is calling us to care more about people than we do about things. Concern for others is more important than possession of things. Then he also says in verse 35, skipping to verse 35, the second part of the verse, lend to those who ask without expecting anything in return. He says, love your enemies, do good, lend, hoping for nothing again. Now the Jews were supposed to lend money to one another without the charging of interest. Everybody understood that. That's part of the Old Testament. That was part of the Jewish tradition that everybody understood. But to lend without the expectation that the borrower would pay back the loan far exceeds any traditions that the Jews observed. And so the point here again is generosity. We lend really in the sense of giving a gift. If we have to lend money to somebody, we agree to do that. Obviously, we use wisdom and common sense when we make that loan. But the idea is that if a person's in need, we don't start calculating, you know, the rate of the interest. We don't start worrying about when they're going to pay it back. A person's in need. I have the resources. I can just give you this. If you want to call it a loan, that's fine. If you can't pay it back, that's fine. I'm not worried about it. I'm more concerned about you than I am about this money or about this car or whatever it is. We lend, we loan, and not worry about repayment. Somebody put it this way, which I thought was good. Jesus' followers give freely without dragging others into the quagmire of never-ending cycles of repayment and liability, and God will lavishly repay them. It's a lot easier simply to give somebody the money and say, don't worry about interest, don't worry about repayment. If you can pay it back in the future, that's fine. If you can't, that's fine. I'm just concerned about you. Here's the money. Just take it. Meet the need. And if in the future God provides and you can pay me back, that's great, but really don't worry about it. I think that's the kind of attitude that he's talking about here. And then notice in verse 38 at the beginning, it says, give and it shall be given unto you. Okay, do you see the theme here? Give generously, loan, don't worry about getting repayment.
Again, verse 38, give and it shall be given unto you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over shall men give into your bosom. From a human perspective, you lose when you give. When you give away your possessions, you naturally have fewer possessions. So from a worldly point of view, you can't gain by giving stuff away. You just don't make money by giving away money. It just doesn't make sense from a worldly point of view. How in the world can you gain by giving away your stuff? But in God's economy, that's exactly what you do. You gain by giving. When we give generously, God has promised to give us generously. We gain by giving. You may remember the verse in 2 Corinthians 9 where Paul says, he who sows sparingly shall reap also sparingly. He who sows generously shall reap also generously. So Jesus tells us the kind of gain that we can expect when we give generously. He says here, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over shall men give into your bosom. So the idea here is you can picture a bushel basket, and maybe you're buying some grain from a farmer or from a merchant of some sort. And so the farmer, the merchant, presses the grain into the basket. He shakes it around so more stuff can be poured into it. The material is so generous, it's just running over the sides. It's a big, big heaping bunch of stuff that is compacted as much as possible to get as much into that bushel basket as you can. And so when we give generously, we receive generously. God's blessing is super abundant. As it says in Malachi 3:10, God will open the storehouse of heaven so we cannot even contain the blessings being poured down on us when we are generous. God has promised to provide generously. Then going back to verse 31, we find a very important portion of the scripture that has been called the golden rule. Verse 31, as ye would have that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. Do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. This is kind of a summary of what it means to love others, to love your enemy. We love people by doing to them what we would want them to do for us. If we would want to be treated well, then we treat other people well. Even if we are uncomfortable, even if things are not going our way, we don't have to treat others badly. We don't use bad language. We don't make a ruckus for others. We don't complain. We don't make things, you know, a mess for other people just because we don't feel good. So we do unto others what we would want them to do to us. Now, I think it's very easy to violate this rule. We often expect to be treated well, even though we don't treat other people well. Just like that belligerent passenger on the aircraft the other day. He certainly expected to be treated well, but he wasn't treating other people well. We expect others to be friendly to us when we're not friendly. I could give you a story about certain people who have complained to me over the years about how people don't treat them very friendly. And these are unfriendly people. They expect others to be friendly to them when they are not friendly to others. Isn't there a verse in the Bible that says, he who hath friends must show himself friendly? And so no doubt we could do better as a church, being warm and friendly and welcoming. But, you know, I think if we want to be treated warmly and as friendly, then we need to express that to others ourselves. Well, the golden rule is a good summary of proper human interaction. We should always treat others as we would want others to treat us. We show sympathy and compassion because we want others to treat us that way. Which really goes right in then to verse 36. Be ye therefore merciful as your Father also is merciful. What is mercy? Mercy is compassion or sympathy. Mercy is not retaliating when you've been mistreated. And the Bible says that God shows mercy to sinners. It says God is merciful. He expects us to do the same. We have to leave revenge to God. That's His business. And so we have to be merciful. We have to relent and not give people what they deserve in the bad way. Then in verse 37, another way we can show love to our enemy, verse 37, judge not, and ye shall not be judged. Condemn not, ye shall not be condemned. Forgive, and ye shall be forgiven. If there's any one statement by Jesus that the world, unsaved people, commonly know, it's this one, these two words, judge not. How often do you hear that
from unsaved people. They may not know any other thing in the whole Bible, but they know that Jesus said, judge not. Well, of course, we know that there are other things that Jesus said as well. Like, for example, Jesus said, judge righteous judgment. Just a little later in the same sermon, before you try to get the speck out of somebody else's eye, get the plank out of your own eye. And so we know that Jesus is not forbidding all forms of judgment, all forms of ethical treatment or coming to ethical decisions. He's simply forbidding here the kind of hypercritical, fault-finding, self-righteous judgmentalism that is often common among believers. We need to get the plank out of our own eye before we try to deal with the spot or the speck in somebody else's eye. He goes on there to say, forgive. Judge not, condemn not, and then forgive, and ye shall be forgiven. The word forgive here is release, literally to set free. In other words, release your enemy from the obligation to be set free from repayment. When somebody does something bad to us, it almost establishes a debt. We feel like we have to pay them back. They did something bad to us, and now we have to do something bad to them because it seems fair. And so when you release or forgive somebody, you are essentially releasing them from that debt that they supposedly owe you. I'm not going to hold you accountable for the things that you did to me. I'm going to release you into God's hands. So we don't hold on to past hurts. We are not concerned about getting back what we've been given. We release them instead. Forgive those who have mistreated you. Release them from indebtedness to you. When we hold on to our past hurts, that develops bitterness. And the Bible tells us not to allow a root of bitterness to develop in our lives. We prevent that bitter root from developing by releasing or forgiving others for the evil that they have done. Now, there is no doubt that we are treated badly. I mean, it's talking here about our enemies who hate us, who do all these terrible things to us. There is no doubt. We certainly affirm that we may be treated badly. And these people deserve some sort of a punishment, but that belongs to God. Vengeance is mine. And so we release them into God's hands. We don't hold on to that hurt. We trust God that He's going to do the right thing, that God is going to bring whatever vengeance, whatever repayment, whatever punishment needs to happen in that case. We let God do it, and we don't pursue it ourselves. So we release others for the evil that they've done to us. Well, these are the rules for Christian conduct. The primary command here is to love our enemies, and we do that by doing good to those who treat us badly and by giving generously without thought of repayment. And we live that way because God is merciful to those who are unthankful and to those who are evil. God has been merciful to us, and so we must be merciful to others. When we love this way, we demonstrate that we truly are the children of God. Now again, love for others doesn't mean that we aid people in their crimes or expose our loved ones to disaster or even death. We don't aid the wicked or encourage their bad conduct. Love means doing what is best for that person from God's perspective. What would God want me to do for this individual? That is love, even if that person is my enemy. Now that is a tall order. In fact, it's impossible without the Spirit of God enabling us to live this way. We need God's grace to enable us to love our enemies. This kind of living requires that we live in constant reliance upon the Spirit of God. This requires a deep commitment to live the way that Jesus wants us to live. So, who is your enemy this morning? Who hates you and says bad things about you? Who consistently mistreats you? Who slaps you on the cheek? Who takes your stuff and doesn't give it back? Well, that's the person that you need to do what is best for him or her. He is the one who needs your mercy. He is the one you need to forgive. And why do we do it? Just because we feel like doing it? No, we do that because that's how God has treated us. We must be merciful to others in the same way that God has been merciful to us. And that means treating others the way that we would want to be treated, even when that other person is unfriendly and belligerent. Well, I don't know if that flight attendant that I talked about was a Christian or not, but she surely acted like one. I wonder if others would say the same thing about us. Let's close in a word of prayer.